Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. It's been a spate of long weekends and breaks from which I hope, you know, all well recovered. And as we wait for the tortured folk who run the African National Congress and to a large extent the government of the country to decide how best to dress up their government of national unity for its second act. Act one ended with a blast as its biggest GNU partner, the Democratic Alliance, successfully defied coalition convention and brought down not one but two ANC budgets. During the intermission, playwriters are furiously working at the script, making it up as they go along. And when the curtains open for Act Two, we'll know whether or not the DA still has a part in the play. Whatever follows, we can be certain, I think, of one thing. There'll be a third and final act, there always is, in which, in all likelihood, the whole thing will come crashing down and we'll have another election. That could be 2029 as scheduled, but boy, 2029 looks a really long way away. One of the chief architects of our current politics, of the outlines of it anyway, as well as its constitutional forebears, is Tony Leon, a former leader of the DA, attendee at the first constitutional negotiations before 1994, author really of many of the best books on our democratic age and malaise, and one of the negotiators of the GNU, and an absolutely unmissable weekly columnist. What I learned also recently about Tony Leon is that he literally forgets nothing. This guy can pull a 300-year-old quotation out of the air at the drop of a hat, and whatever clever point you think you've just made, Tony could, if he chose to, immediately remember an ancient philosopher's withering response to exactly the original point you think you're making. It must be one of the reasons he keeps on writing books. He carries them all in his head all the time, and writing them down must be a form of unburdening himself. Tony, thank you for joining me. Your latest book, Being There, published by Jonathan Ball and out next week, is just lovely. It's rich in anecdote, full of wisdom, and I'm happy to say I'll be launching it with you in Cape Town next week. But before then, please forgive me. There's a small matter of the VAT war and the future of our coalition government in whose formation you played such a big part. And I want to talk about the DA. Do you think, just for a start, let's kick off with this. Do you think the GNU is going to survive? And if it does, will the DA be party to it? And will that, in your view, be a good thing?
Thank you very much, Peter, both for the warm introduction. And let me repay you in coins of the same currency. Are you also an unmissable weekly columnist? And I always enjoy what you write. Don't agree with every word of it. Perhaps last weekend, we might have had a minor disagreement, but I greatly enjoy your writing too. So it's not a mutual admiration society, but you do ask three very important questions rolled into one. And if I can take the Fifth Amendment or its equivalent, say, I simply don't know. I was told by a DA insider, and I'm absolutely not part of the current standoff between the ANC and the DA, as I was last year, that the GNU is critical but stable. I don't know if that's going to pertain or improve, but I guess it means for the time being, it does continue. As to your question, whether it should, that's difficult. You know, I did a podcast for another entity 3 weeks ago when the GNU crisis was at its height. It actually looked much worse then than it does today, but everything is relative, Peter. And the moderator of the podcast, and I think it was largely a sort of middle-class, perhaps even largely white audience, therefore probably indicative of the DA base, asked the audience, and there were a lot of people watching it apparently, do you think the DA should continue in the GNU? And the answers were quite interesting. The 50% said the DA should continue under all circumstances or any circumstances. 49% said the DA should stay under improved terms and conditions. And only 1% of those viewers said the DA should leave. And I think that's also reflected in recent polling across the board, that somehow or other, even though the GNU has had a very modest achievement record to date, I think that's quite clear. And I'm not talking about individual ministries which might have done well, but I mean overall as a collective, it's been very glacial, any progress, and there's been a lot of regression. Most South Africans seem to think a GNU or a government in which the ANC is not the only party is a very good thing. And that seems to apply not just to the significant majority of DA supporters, but interestingly, to a majority of ANC supporters, looking at the recent polling. So I think there's almost a disconnect, Peter, between the achievements or the lack of them of the GNU and the fact that most folk out there seem to think it's a much better idea than one-party government under the ANC. And I think that will influence the DA thinking as well, because they read the same polls. Indeed, they commission many polls themselves, which I think probably go to the same answer.
And what about the DA itself then? Is it divided, overstaying or walking away? Or if it is, how divided is it? I mean, we know that there are people in the DA who think it shouldn't be, but I mean, are they a minority? Does the leadership want to stay?
I think the leadership does want to stay. Both the leader and the very powerful federal chair, Helen Ziller, have both signaled that.
Yeah.
It was interesting, and I don't involve myself in the daily goings on in the DA, but I do get quite a lot of feedback from people in it. And one of the people who contacted me, whom I've known for a long time, who's a parliamentarian, who's very much, you could say, part of the GNU skeptic faction in the DA, and obviously it's a big party and they're different views as there should be and need to be. He said to me, or he wrote to me, he said, you know, this stance on VAT, and this is before the court case successfully brought it to a conclusion, has restored my faith in the DA's decision to be in the GNU itself. So in other words, standing up at that point, as they did, or for all the reasons, good, bad, or indifferent, however you interpret it, actually, I think, solidified the DA's internal position on remaining in the GNU, because it said, well, we are here, but we're not just going to put up with anything and everything. And where necessary, we'll take the fight outside the GNU. And I think that did fortify some of the people inside the DA who were the most skeptical about its continuation in the government.
In a way, though, you know, the DA going to court, the way the fight over VATs turned out or unfolded, I wonder whether the DA would have handled it differently if it could start all over again, because it sometimes seemed really muddled. You know, there it was asking for the devolution of some powers to the Western Cape, pretty much, you know, rail, et cetera, et cetera. Then it was a string of very sensible economic reforms that it suggested. And only then it seemed to go to court. Maybe I've got myself a little muddled, but it's been a very confusing thing to follow. But one wonders whether each of these kind of positions might have belonged to different wings of the party. When it was asking the government, effectively, you know, for its support for VAT, could it please run its own commuter trains or have more privatization in the Port of Cape Town? What party was that talking then? And was it the same party that later would go to court and win this really quite stunning victory in court?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of the detail there, and it is a bit confusing. And I'm certainly not an expert, but my understanding, for what it's worth, of the timeline is this. The ANC gave the DA and all the other partners of government about 2 hours to look at the budget or signal their approval or disapproval. The DA disapproved. And the moment that happened, instead of the ANC and the first budget vote or speech was abandoned, as you recall, in February, at that point, the ANC did not engage the DA. They just froze the DA out. Deputy Minister of Finance, the DA ministers were not consulted further. And immediately the ANC started shopping around for support outside the GNU. So, when Helen Ziller correctly describes a low trust environment, that was the beginning of the current phase of low trust. And then when the ANC later on, after the second introduction, the budget with the reduced but still maintained VAT increase was put in, immediately started creating a caucus of parties, of small and smaller parties, outside the GNU to support the budget in the fiscal framework in the finance committee. I think at that point, as I understand it, the DA said, well, if this goes ahead and after we vote on the fiscal framework or vote against the fiscal framework, we think that the fiscal framework was improperly passed, that finance committee meeting was basically unlawful. And the vote of parliament was therefore based on an illegality, if you like. We need to challenge that aspect. And so at that point, they went to court. So I think they are connected, as you say, But I think the steps that were taken along the way by the ANC forced the DA's hand to go and try and seek support. Clearly, it received legal advice along the way that what was going on in the Finance Committee, what was being presented to Parliament, was unlawful. And they had a good case, which proved to be the case. So I think they are connected, but in a way, they're not quite the same thing. And look, we now where we are. So we, as I understand the order of court in the Western Cape, basically the whole process has to start again, Peter. So presumably there'll now be a third budget or third attempt at a budget.
Yeah. So Tony, just from the party that went into this negotiation, and you were part of those negotiations, and you write very eloquently and compellingly against them, to the party that's there now, has it changed or have you changed? Because you were very critical of Helen Zille when you went into those negotiations. And I'm just going to quote from you, where you make the point that John Steenhuisen called you up one Sunday and said, please, would you join the negotiating team? And before you knew, you'd said yes, and before you knew it, Helen Zille had inserted herself into the process. And advised you that not only has the FedEx inserted her and party chairman Ivan Bay into the mix, but that she would be now in charge of the group. And you later say that Helen Zille adds a great deal of rigor to the party management, but I doubt you say the party brand is enhanced by her continued presence at the top of the organization. Her relish for public confrontation often takes the shine and attention away from the leader, John. Having gone through the negotiation and watched her win this fight over VAT, do you still feel the same way?
Well, listen, I do have very high regard for Helen. I also, you know, we're not without our mutual disagreements and misunderstandings of each other. I mean, I did say, and I hate to quote myself of her, in the same page you quoted from, there is much to admire in her outsized personality, some 6 years older than me.
Yeah.
She has the undimmed energies of someone 20 years younger than her 72-year-old self. She has a piercing intelligence and considerable personal and political courage. And when not a dagger's drawn, as we sometimes will be in the weeks ahead, we have a warm mutual understanding. So, you know, look, Helen and I have go back three decades now. And I think she's a remarkable political personality and a very interesting human being. But I certainly am not a, you know, I don't subscribe to everything she says and does. Our relationship, you know, is longstanding, and it evolved over during those negotiations. So we had some furious rows. Mm. But what interested me, just using Helen as a reference point to your question, is that Helen's own thinking evolved during the negotiations, last year's negotiations. So she started off, as I say, very much not thinking the DA should go into a government, ANC, and then landed up after looking at the landscape as it was as we were heading towards the final outcome of this and saying, well, actually, we don't really have a choice except to go in, and we better get the best terms and conditions we possibly can. So she is an evolving thinker. She's very adamant, I think sometimes too adamant, and she certainly all the attributes and the misattributes I describe in my view, and she no doubt has many about me, or she's expressed quite a few of them in her own book.
Yeah.
But what impressed me about Helen during that phase, and it might apply now, but I'm not involved in this current round, is that she doesn't sort of die in the ditch. She moves, she evolves, and that's what you need to be. And look, the point is that whatever I think or you think or people think, I mean, Helen's mandate to be the number two person in the party was not self-imposed. She was elected by a healthy majority by her party, so that's their decision. Whatever I think of it's actually pretty irrelevant to the party.
Whether she dies in the ditch or not, other people die in the ditch, do they not? I mean, I tried to get hold of Ryan Kutsi the other day thinking he'd be in Cape Town. And he's not. He's in Dubai, out of it. And he was very circumspect. He wouldn't tell me why. But, I mean, I can only guess that he and Helen have fallen out in some way and that she won and he lost. And, you know, you make the point, and I'm going to ask you the question again. You say, and you had a lot of time to think about this, you say, I doubt the party brand is enhanced by her continued presence at the top of the organization. That's quite a statement, Tony. I mean, do you Do you still think that?
Well, I think she's very managerially helpful to the party. Whether she's brand positive, probably not. But look, that's my view. It's not the it's not the view of the DA. Clearly, the DA majority think that she should be the chair of the party. I just think if you're you know that you when you have a new leader elected, you should have a new leadership team, and that was my view. I think Helen did remarkably good work in helping the party to recover after the debacle of the 2019 election, and really was a setback.
Yeah.
Well, here we are, what, 6 years later, and I'm, you know, it's not for me to say, they must decide. I would, you know, I only look at it from my point of view. I left the party leadership in 2007. I'm called back on, you know, high days and holy days to lend a hand, which I'm happy to do because I believe in the project. But I wouldn't choose to reinsert myself into the top leadership of the party. But that's just me.
Yeah. So talking about the way the GNU works, right? So as you were saying in the book, and I mean, I can't tell listeners enough how much I enjoyed this, how much I enjoy your account. And I'm sorry that you had to write it before the end of this, right? But I'm sure later editions of the book.
Well, I do manage to shoehorn in two paragraphs about the current budget debacle, but that was really due to the heroics of my
You're very good.
To manage to get up, stop the presses. Yes. And I thought, well, there's now this budget disaster. Yeah. Let's put in something. So we managed to insert something about it.
But, you know, the question that's on my mind is, I mean, how you know, from what we know, the sort of DA law about the DA is that it's fabulously well-informed, has the most brilliant polling, always knows what's going on. Obviously, like all political parties, has an answer to everything. Yet when the elections results come out after the 29th of May last year, it's taken by surprise. It wasn't, because if it hadn't been taken by surprise, it would have known that it should have had a raft of coalition negotiating points ready. And those were going to be the points that it would use. And there wouldn't have had to be this frenzied two-week negotiation that you write about in the book, because it would have all been thought out beforehand and anticipated. And it wasn't anticipated because they didn't know, because they were taken by surprise. Whatever polling they were seeing, it wasn't good enough to forewarn them about the opportunity that was about to arise.
I think that's very valid criticism. But and let me say, actually, in my dining room, a meeting was convened of DA people in the top leadership about 6 weeks before the election, called by John Steenhuisen, who said, let's look at post-election scenarios. And then we started looking at them and deciding, you know, how we might approach it in a general sense. And then, of course, the demands and rigors of the election campaign started to dominate everything. And that discussion was never concluded. Well, certainly wasn't concluded before the end of May. And so we had to pick up with a very kind of only a very general departure point after the election happened. I think there was a disbelief, because I don't think the DA or anyone else, even though some of the polls showed it, really believed on election day the ANC would do as badly as the ANC did. Or if they saw that, they thought, you know, this is what the polls are showing a few weeks out or a few days after an election. But on election day, what always happens is the DA vote gets squeezed, or the ANC vote gets improves, you know, at the last minute. And that last minute surge for the ANC never happened for the first time in 30 years last year. So I think there was a degree of surprise. I think there was arguably a lack of advanced preparation, although it had been anticipated. I just think it was very hard to habituate to the idea that actually the ANC is going to do as badly as it will do, or as it proved to do. They thought, well, it might do badly, might fall below 40, might fall below 50, but about 45, and then it'll scrabble together a coalition. But the idea that actually it would do so badly as the ANC did, that it'll be incapable of really putting together a coalition absent of either the DA or the EFF, was sort of there in the background, but was never fully worked through. So I think that's fair comment. Yeah. But look, you know, stuff happens, as the defense.
Yeah. America said. Events, dear boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And okay, right now we're about to go into May 25. What's the point of staying in the GNU? Why fight so hard to stay in there? Is it because of the polling, or do you think does the party think? Do Helen and John think they can actually make a difference?
Well, I think they do think they can make a difference. The asset question you've asked for is whether they will make a difference. I have to say, the evidence is not encouraging so far on making a difference to the overall trajectory. I think the evidence is very encouraging on some key ministries where the DA really has proven itself to be effective. The obvious ones are the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure, the Department of Home Affairs, maybe even basic education, though that's almost impossible to turn around. But I mean,
it's a tough one. Yeah.
There seem to be a few encouraging policies and practices coming out of there. And then even, the more invisible ministers, the so-called Kortbrook ministers, before he was frozen up by Godongwana, someone like Asher Sirupan, the Deputy Minister of Finance, was very effective behind the scenes. Deputy ministers are usually behind the scenes. So I think in the individual ministries, the answer is yes. I think the overall trajectory of government, not yet. And there's little time. So, I was asked this morning by someone. I was actually doing an event with this book, and I have a chapter in my book, as you know, about Shimon Peres. And for all the quotes I didn't quote this one. It's the best quote of all. And because this guy asked me in the audience this morning, he said, "Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of the country?" And I said, "Let me quote you Shimon Peres." So let me now call on my mind of quotations, Peter. And Peres said, "Optimists and pessimists die the same, but they live differently." And, if you take a pessimistic view and you look at the unemployment rate, you look at our growth rate seems to have been cut in half between the announcement and the budget and what the IMF has forecast, the World Bank for us now. And so that's very pessimistic. And if you also come to the conclusion that actually the DA's window in the government is quite narrow, because I suspect at the end in December 2027, which is what, 19 months away, Peter, the ANC will elect a new leader. And I think the new leader, one of his calling cards, seems to be it will be a him, will be on an anti-DA ticket. And therefore, whether the DA survives beyond 2027 in the run-up to the 2029 election must be open to question. If you live as an optimist, as Mr. Perry suggests you should, you could say, well, look, anything is possible in the next 18 months, and we've got to give it our best go, and we've got to try and, even Sisyphean as the task may be, to push the boulder up the hill, and maybe we'll just advance it a bit, and then people will be see that our participation has helped. But I must give you the negative answer, which is also in the positive on the optimistic side. Mm. And I do deal with this quite a lot in my book, and I describe an encounter at a lunch of a big bank in December last year. I think what most people in the both business and even in the general population like about the DA's participation in this government is actually nothing to do with the DA's achievement or lack of achievement. It has everything to do with keeping out the worse alternative. And I think that worse alternative in these people's minds, which is the EFF, MK, and that whole populist RET faction, that if the DA exits the government, that is a kind of that's opening the door to that option. And I think people are really freaked out, probably quite correctly, at that possibility. So even if the DA doesn't achieve what it sets out to achieve, simply being there, to misquote the borrowed title of my book, is actually better than the alternative.
The worry is obviously that being there damages you rather than helps you, because you get to 26 or you get to 29. Unemployment is higher. The growth rate, as you say, is halved. Gwen Ramakgopa, who you quote in the fourth or fifth meeting, the first big meeting you have with the ANC after the election, one of the first people to speak at this meeting is ANC Treasurer Gwen Ramakgopa, who you say is dressed in an impressive and no doubt expensive grey ensemble. She says redress must be at the core of the new government. And they'll still be saying that at the end of the new government, because that's what they think. They think redress trumps growth. Because you don't have to grow to redress. You just basically shuffle money around until, you know, so you take away and give. It's a zero-sum game. There's no growth, and there's no evidence. Whatever Leon Schreiber might do at Home Affairs, whatever Dean McPherson might do at Public Works, they can make there's good PR, and they do some great stuff, and we're grateful that they're there doing important things. But you can't move the beast, you know, and thinking that you can is really dangerous, because you will end up being eaten by this thing. I say you. I mean, you know, it's not your problem anymore, but it's John Steenhuisen's problem. Not even Helen Zillers. It's John Steenhuisen's problem. How does he grow the DA vote come these next coming elections? Because that's his job, if he's still going to be there when that happens. How does he grow that vote while at the same time keeping this completely useless government in power?
Everything you say there is entirely valid, and a lot of it has a lot of credence. But once again, Peter, you know, to quote the American policy as once described in North Korea, which they said, well, there's no good policy. This is the land of lousy options. It's not that you're dealing between, well, if the DA departs the government tomorrow, which, as I said, in the one focus call webinars on, had only 1% support among folk, I imagine we're about 100% DA. So if the DA were to depart tomorrow and then distance themselves from the mess of this government and all the compromises or the lack of compromise in it, would the DA in South Africa be better off for that fact? To quote again Mr. Rumsfeld, that's a known unknown. We simply don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure South Africa would be better off. I don't actually know that a polling suggests the DA wouldn't be better off. Now, the DA set its own metrics for its achievement in government, and I mentioned in my book not because they're a state secret, but because they were said. And then one is to raise economic growth and simultaneously, or correspondingly, to dent unemployment. If at the end of their stay in government, neither of those have been achieved, in fact, there's been a reversal, then the DA is going to have to do a lot of explaining. So it's, you know, if I was one of those ministers or deputy ministers, I would be working night and day in my little corner of the government to make sure that I was living up to that objective that I'd set for myself, that the DA set for itself as the DA. Now, you might say, well, this is mission impossible. It can't be done because you're dealing with an immovable force and dead weight to the ANC. Maybe you're right, but maybe you must. That doesn't exempt you from trying to do what you can from where you are with what you've got. So I think that's it's not easy, and it's quite a big ambition.
Yeah.
Let's see. Look, the jury's out, Peter. We don't know. There will be an early test of the DA's success or failure in the government long before the next general election. In the local elections, which in a way are a national referendum of themselves with real people voting, not just polls. So I think, you know, we can profitably have this discussion, if you ever invite me back on your podcast, in about a year's time.
Always.
The local elections.
Yeah.
And then we'll see.
Yeah. You see, I mean, the sort of dead weight that you talk about is also in the DA, because the DA doesn't have the kind of conversations when it was in opposition that might lead it to the point where it can come up with alternative economic policies to what the ANC does. You know, I've argued this many times before, that they don't talk about economics in the DA. They talk about crime and corruption and you know, there's so many juicy targets out there that the sort of, you know, the boring grind of describing how economic growth works and how it might be encouraged in South Africa doesn't, you know, isn't interesting, and people won't print it, doesn't get you on the television. But, you know, before the next election, hopefully, I mean, there's a federal Congress, I think, next year, round about this time of next year, in which I really hope that the DA elects a completely new leadership, including a new head of FedEx, including a new leader, so that it can reasonably, if it needs to, which it's absolutely guaranteed to need to, leave the government of the GNU, particularly after the next election, and sit and formulate a response to our economic disaster that has some credibility. Because at the moment, It's no good standing up and saying we want to create more jobs. You have to decide, you have to describe how you're going to do it, what exactly you're going to do to create the jobs. And the DA doesn't do that.
Let me say this. I actually was, and I've never met him, except we had an exchange via LinkedIn. But I was very impressed with the performance and the posture of the new, relatively new DA finance spokesman, a chap called Dr. Mark Burke, doctor, who actually seems to, and I asked someone about him, apparently, you know, he's a very successful entrepreneur, business guy, and he's financially literate. Now, this doesn't sound like it's a big ask.
Yeah.
Expect the finance. I'm not, the finance minister has a grasp. He's certainly very, very shaky on how budgets get passed or the legalities. And he's minister of finance, so God help us how the rest of the food chain works there. So I think he is a breath of fresh air inside the DA, and I hope he uses the credibility that he's obtained from this, because he's very credible, to do it precisely what you think needs to be done. But, you know, Peter, I just want to say something here, and I'm not sure you need detailed – you do need detailed policies, obviously, but, you know, it's the theory of the case. The DA, as I understood – well, certainly the DAI when I led it, and perhaps even today, I don't know – is completely at variance with the ANC's transformation agenda. It doesn't subscribe. It worships in a different temple from the ANC temple on that. And we've had a very tragic, real-life, 31-year experiment with the ANC's idea of economics. I mean, you know, you can argue during the Mbeki Manuel years, we were credible and financially literate. We were, in terms of the public finances, were outstandingly well managed, look even better now than they did then. But in terms of the sort of macroeconomic reforms that would really create a growth spurt and dent unemployment, you know, Thabo kind of started it and then, you know, felt imprisoned by his own movement from actually going further. And so you can, you know, Asgisa, we're talking ancient history, was never implemented, or it was half-heartedly done and then abandoned. And even the National Development Plan is gathering dust in some desk somewhere, unattended to and unmourned, apparently, by the ANC, even though it was their great claim. So I think because the DA is radically different from the ANC in its kind of view of the states, of the state and citizen of business and government, it's very difficult for the DA to make common cause with the ANC around economic policy. And I think just that difference is the starting point, which rather surprised me. I know you're a big punter, as you were on Sunday, of Songezo Zibi. You know, he's got a two-seater in Parliament, and you were talking up, and apparently Cyril's, you know.
You once had a two-seater, so there's, you know, there you go.
I didn't create I inherited a seven-seat party. I didn't start off.
Sure.
If I just to be technically correct, and then became a 38-seat party. Anyway, leaving aside that minor detail of history, I think Songezo is a very decent guy, and I think he, you know, a lot of what he does and says is sensible, but he completely buys it to the ANC worldview. And so does Musi Maimane. It's why he's more comfortable leading a two-seat party than was leading a much bigger DA, because actually that's the worldview as well. And I mean, I think the DA distinction is what it needs to build on, that actually everything that's been done for the last 31 years in terms of where we've got to now has been a failure. We need to start with a radically different approach. Now, there's an enormous pushback against that because, you know, a lot of the public space is captured by people who believe in the transformation NDR ideology. I don't think if the DA is going to succeed, and I'm not talking about as a participant in government where it's limited because it's only 20%, as an alternative, that it can do anything other, however difficult it is, to actually plant a very different looking flag in the soil of South Africa. That's my view. And this book, to the extent I deal with that, actually suggests why this should be so.
I completely agree with that. But what it has to do, it has to, I mean, you know, the whole point about transformation in Africa, you have to have an economic center to what you are thinking. And you don't have one in the DA yet. And that's because because South Africa is such an inviting political story because of race and what's happened. It was an easy story to tell, you know, look out of your office building in 19, 75 at a street corner anywhere, and there'd be some outrage taking place simply because of the laws. And so it hasn't encouraged people, particularly in the opposition, to think about how you structure an economy so that the people who are now voting for ANC would think, actually, that's a much more interesting prospect. I could start my own business. I can be in charge of myself. I can be an entrepreneur. I can be rich. I can make money. I can make a future for my kids. And the DA doesn't sell that.
I think that is entirely the sales pitch that is needed. I agree. Whether they sell it or not, I can't comment because I don't follow that as closely. I think you're correct, though. You know, what really encouraged me, because, you know, when I was the leader, it's a long time ago, when I was the leader of the opposition parliament, you know, we stood up against all this employment equity stuff that is now, you know, being rammed down everyone's throats. You know, the latest regulations are a flight of ideological madness in a country
completely
unemployed people. They want more of it. Yeah. But you know what was very interesting to me is that I was reading this poll that most South Africans do not support BEE.
Yes.
It precisely because BEE hasn't helped most South Africans. It's helped an elite South Africa. Yeah. And you know, you go my old friend Moletsi Mbeki. You know, we often agree and we sometimes disagree, but we're on warm terms. Yeah. Moletsi Mbeki has made this point for, I don't know, the last 15 years. And lo and behold,
years and years. Yeah.
It is now the received wisdom, not in the ANC, which seems to be completely isolated from any kind of wisdom.
Yeah.
But among, as they used to say in the old South Africa, default Dart beta, that most folk actually do not support BE because it doesn't support them. Well, there you have it. I mean,
look, it was a small poll, Tony. It was about 800 people, right?
So I don't know what to
don't get too excited about. But no, absolutely. I mean, it's a very interesting poll. And BEE's now on the table, I think, in a big way.
But you know, can I just deal with? I noticed there's been a lot made. I don't know whether it's real or imagined about this warmed up or the warmth of one phone call between the mighty Donald J. Trump and Cyril, which was much spoken of last week during the Zelensky visit just before. You know, a very wise business guy who's actually tries to help improve governance in this country. And, you know, was part of a delegation that went to Washington just after Rousseau was expelled. And he said to me, what really sticks in the craw of the Trump administration, much more than never mind Palestine, Israel, Iran even, is DEI. That is their complete anathema to Trump. Yes. And here is South Africa, as a sort of DEI casebook, practicing DEI in the form of BE, for example. So I think, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, I'm all very sensitive about sovereign independence.
Yeah.
I think if you're going to make headway in Trump world, if you wish to, then you've got to look at that, even if, and when you have this, you know, huge force of the American administration coupled with a lot of popular disaffection here, maybe you're right, maybe it will be up for reconsideration. But look, there are so many vested interests who've benefited that
for
going to be very hard.
No, I mean, the only way is the DA has to be the party that owns the alternative here. But to do it, you've got to get younger people in the party, like the young man, young Burke that you were talking about. Now, the finance spokesman, he's very good. He's very clever. And those are the people whose voices, you know, you need to see at the front of the party. I know it's not going to happen, but at the party elections next year, I really think the DA, whether it's in or out of the government, needs to change its leadership and get some younger people in there with a new dynamic, new approach to South Africa. But listen, there's a lot to talk about in your book. And fortunately, I get a second chance to do this in Cape Town next week. I'm interested in the rise of anti-Semitism because nowadays, these anti-Semitics are the people who claim to be fighting it, like Putin, you know, and he's trying to get rid of the Nazis in Ukraine. I mean, you know, you can't make this stuff up. You've got fantastic insights in the book into nostalgia, into the way we misremember our past, into your dad and your own start in politics back in 1986, I think, when you won a close election by just 20 votes, which your agent found underneath the pile of somebody.
Yes, well, there were actually 39 votes, but really, I had this recurring nightmare. I still, bizarrely enough, get it. This was 1996, nearly 40 years later. That actually, of 20 people, I mean, I'm not great at maths, but I do know actually 39, you only need 20 to vote another way, and then you lose. You don't need to just hop for that amount.
Yeah.
So that was really close. And, you know, thanks to Alan Gadd, who discovered the missing pile of votes sitting under the National Party candidates column, I would never have gone into politics likely. And then, you know, my whole life would have taken a different course. And so it goes. Sliding Doors was the movie that.
It's a great movie. You grab hold of Ian McEwan, the fabulous English novelist, his remark about the irreducible urge to win, to make the point that so much of our lives is driven by competition, no matter how earnestly we may be to deny it. Anyway, watching you win, as you continue to do, is great because you're colorful about trying and you make it fun to be a spectator. So good luck with being there, Tony, and thank you for being with me. Thank you for listening to everybody. I appreciate it. I'll be back next week with another edition of Podcast from the Edge. Until then, stay safe. Bye-bye.